And in this part of the show, we're very pleased to have with us once again May Barenbaum. She is an entomologist. That means she's a scientist who specializes in studying insects. She is, in fact, head of the Department of Entomology at the University of Illinois. And from time to time, over a number of years now, she's visited with us on a fairly regular basis to talk about insects, and it's always a lot of fun to have her here on the program. The one thing that I always say at the beginning here is I say, now, maybe you have an insect problem around your home and your garden, and you need to get rid of it. Well, this is not the time for that. We save the extermination questions for another time. We got a guy for that. And I'm sure sometime soon here, Phil Nixon will be on the program, and we can talk about that, talk about how it is if you have some insect problem and you can't live with them. And one thing I want to say about Phil is that one of the first things he sort of says is, well, is this something you can live with? If you can't, well, he'll tell you what to do about it. But this is a different sort of thing. When May is here, what we try to do is just appreciate insects for the amazing variety and the range of how it is they make their lives and go about doing what they do. And also maybe to appreciate their place in the environment and all the things that they do and how maybe the world wouldn't be such a great place if we didn't have insects. So that's what these shows are all about. If you have questions, you can certainly call us. And if for example, you've seen a particular insect and you're not quite sure what it is, you can call in, give us the best description that you possibly can. And there's probably a pretty good chance that May can say, oh, yes, I can tell you what that is and tell you some more about that. So any of all of that, that's certainly welcome. 333-9455 is the number. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you got questions, you can give us a call. Well, it's good to have you with us once again.
Always a pleasure to be here.
Thought that maybe we could start out, probably every time we've seen you, probably the last few times, we've talked about colony collapse disorder and what it is that, and what it is, perhaps people have indeed heard of it by now, but also the progress that scientists have been making and try to figure out what's going on. So at this point, what do we know about colony collapse disorder? And is there, in fact, anything new since the last time that we talked about this?
I think, not sure what the state was. I think it was probably last year in February. And I guess the only really new thing is not particularly good news that we've had another season. February is the time of year when half of America's bees head to California to pollinate the almond crop. And almonds are a huge business, $3 billion business in California, and it's an ever-expanding business. And the greater the acreage, the higher the demand for the bees. And it's actually in connection with the almond pollination season that colony collapse disorder really came to light. And once again, this year, the big beekeepers, the guys who drive, you know, thousands of colonies to California, suffered losses. And the estimate is between 30% and 40%. So yet again, another year, America's bee reserve has been depleted by 30% to 40%. So it is still worrisome on the scientific front. There have been a number of efforts, not much else in the published literature. There was a promising finding in the fall that promising, I guess, in the sense that a virus that had not hitherto been reported in the U.S. was discovered, but was associated with colony collapse disorder. But subsequent work revealed that this particular virus has actually been in the U.S. for at least 4 years, and it was just discovered as a consequence of the genetic investigation into collapsing colonies and may simply reflect a compromised immune system on the part of these collapsing, these dying bees. I know there are ongoing studies, but at the moment, there's no nothing in the scientific literature that represents a significant advance.
So is the thinking that it may in fact not be one, you're not going to be able to point to one single thing, that it might be a combination of things that might be in the environment, potential, who knows, viruses, toxins, pesticides.
Reduced genetic variation because of the way bees are bred, the stress of moving them around. There there every sort of environmental ill, I think, has been brought in as a possible hypothesis. And there are a number of people. Well, actually, there's one book that's coming out in September that basically posits that it's a combination of stresses. And the take-home message is if, in fact, colony collapse, if, in fact, Israeli acute paralysis virus is the trigger, eliminating that, treating that virus still won't help America's apiculture industry because there are, you know, other dozens of other problems. There's at least one book I heard in preparation that's claiming to attribute colony collapse disorder to the neonicotinoid insecticides. And there's, as far as I know, nothing in the refereed scientific literature that incontrovertibly links colony collapse disorder to these insecticides. But that doesn't stop someone from writing a book. So, I think there's a veritable explosion of books about bees in the last 12 months, which I think is a good thing. People should know more about bees.
All right. We have a couple callers here. May Barenbaum is our guest. She's head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I and is here to talk about insects. If you have questions, we'd like to exercise your curiosity and appreciation for insects. Give us a call, 333-9455 and toll free, 800-222-9455. We have two callers here ready to go, both in Urbana. First, line number one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I'm a new beekeeper, and so I'm interested in the bees, but that's not what I called you about. I was reading about some ants, and they were described as being in the Houston, Texas area.
Funny you should mention that.
one of the guys in the control room said this morning that he had been reading about this
yeah.
The crazy raspberry.
The crazy raspberry. Yeah.
Yes, and said
know?
We could talk about that. I'll ask May. I think she knows about crazy ants. She said, I'm not so sure about the raspberry part.
Was your question was what's going on with these crazy raspberry ants?
Well, I read a little bit of the article, and it said there already were crazy ants apparently in the United States, but then these are some crazier ants that came in.
Even crazier.
Yes. Yeah, even wilder and crazier.
The psychopathic ants.
Yeah.
The term crazy ant is a reference to a group of ants that, as you said, we already have in this country. They're what's typically called the crazy ant is scientific name is Paratrachina longicornis, and these are so-called sweet ants. They like, you know, they feed on sweet things and general food debris. And animal matter in particular, they'll eat other insects, and they have earned their name by virtue of their habit of sort of running aimlessly every which way, which is why they're called crazy. There are other ants that you'll often see walking in a nice straight, you know, rows, like with military precision. Not these guys. These guys run around everywhere. And that's why they're called crazy ants. The crazy ant, the one that, up until now, we mostly had to deal with species Paratrachinus longicornis. It's about a tenth of an inch long. It's sort of brownish black and is mostly distinguished by virtue of its habit of running every which way. I guess crazy. I must say I haven't read the reports of crazy raspberry ants. I have two colleagues actually in the department who are ant experts.
They were named raspberry because the fellow who was most studying them was named raspberry. Apparently.
Yeah, not because they particularly
not
liked raspberry.
Color, right?
or not because they make rude sounds with the...
Nothing. No joke that you can possibly come up with. No.
But the thing that interested me about them was that they crawl everywhere and they were getting into electronic equipment and causing outages and problems with computers.
Fire ants, which are also in the Houston area throughout Texas, huge problems as well as about 250 million other acres in the U.S. are notorious for crawling into electrical equipment, chewing off insulation and causing shorts and literally causing fires. They initially were called fire ants because their venom creates a fiery burn, but they also literally create fires. They also have shorted out traffic lights and caused traffic accidents. So Yeah, there's something about electromagnetic radiation that is attractive to certain types of ants, and they get into electrical equipment and really wreak havoc.
Wow. Okay. I'll keep my computer sealed up then. I don't know if they come up here. I'm still wondering if they can make it through the freezing, and, you know, as much as we don't freeze much anymore, but... It gets cold.
That's the one, you know, the one, as I say almost every time, the one thing we can be thankful for about Illinois winter is it keeps us safe from killer bees and fire ants and maybe crazy raspberry ants, too.
Okay. So. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. And I guess the other thing that I think is noteworthy about this is that this would be another case of an accidental introduction of a non-native species. They didn't start out here in the United States. Apparently, they came in, they think that they came in aboard a cargo ship. And that in the first time that they were, according to the article that I read, the first time that they were introduced or spotted was in 2002. And that according to Roger Gold, he's an entomologist at Texas A&M, he says at this point it would be almost impossible to eradicate them because they've become so widely dispersed.
Well, so many of our most noxious ant pests are, in fact, introduced from elsewhere. The Argentine ant, as the name suggests, has been an ecological disaster throughout the world where it's been transported. The ants, in particular, are real risk factors for invasion because they're small. They tend to be associated with human possessions, and they have the capacity to build up to huge numbers. The Argentine ant's technical name, the fire ant's technical name is red imported fire ant. It is not native to North America. The Argentine ant isn't native to North America. There's a whole group of ants called tramp ants, and it's not, you know, a reflection on their moral rectitude or anything. It's basically their habits of stowing away and getting transported all over the world.
The other thing about this that also seems to be problematic is that they're pretty tough, and they you can't use over-the-counter pesticides to kill them. And here's the great part, and I'm reading this as a story from the Associated Press, and it says here, when you do kill these ants, the survivors turn to their advantage. They pile up the dead, sometimes using them as a bridge to cross safely over surfaces treated with pesticide.
Yeah.
Pretty smart.
Pretty smart. They're pretty awesome, though. And you know, in fact, you could do an entire Focus 580 with ants. And as I was saying, I have a couple of colleagues who are ant experts, and there's certainly enough ants in the world that causing enough troubles and having – well, in fact, one of my colleague, Andy Suarez, was involved in a project documenting the fastest known muscular contraction in the animal kingdom is the trap jaw ant. It's an ant that basically snaps its jaw shut and can propel itself somersaulting into the air, and it can do this to escape from enemies and also to pursue saltatorial prey or prey that jump up and down too. And they're really fascinating, and it's an astonishing bit of physiological capability. It's too bad there's no Olympic event and muscular contraction. They beat out the snapping shrimp. Up until that work was done by Andy Suarez and his colleagues, the snapping shrimp held the distinction of the fastest muscular contraction.
Snapping shrimp. See, that's why we have her on the show, to tell us stuff like this. Snapping shrimp. Let's go to line number two. This is also an Urbana caller. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Last time May Birnbaum was on, I told her the story about a spider. Do you remember that? The spider in my backyard that I watched weave a
maybe
a week or two every night.
And we talked about spiders taking down their webs and relocating if the prey rate of prey capture goes down.
Well, I forgot to tell you one very interesting part of that story, and that was that this web was attached to a clothesline between my house and the garage, the top part of it was, and then partly to the garage. And then she or he dropped, like, from 7 feet high, where the web was, down to the ground on a thread, and then I think must have attached it to a plant down there, and then crawled all the way back up again. And I thought that was so amazing, the seven-foot thread.
It is astonishing. Yeah,
even higher. It might have been 8 feet.
So there are garden spiders who will, and Nephila, spiders in the genus Nephila, will make webs that are 20 feet across.
Oh, my God.
And that involves enormous traverses. This is the silk that they drop down is called dragline silk. And it's often used sort of to, they'll drop down and provide an anchor, and then that particular line will be one of the scaffolds in a much larger web. It's a remarkably efficient way of getting around if you're a spider, I guess.
Oh, I just was so amazed. And how did that little spider create that string so fast out of that tiny little body?
Well, you know, spinning a dry fiber, and basically silk is a liquid when it's in the spider body, and it comes out as a dry fiber.
How does it get dry so fast?
That is a manufacturing technological engineering question that has defied human ingenuity. This is one of the – there's apparently a recent finding that this ability to spin a dry fiber has been replicated in the laboratory. But up until now, this has only been possible with, you know, corrosive acids and ultra-high temperatures. And as you point out, the spider doesn't use any fancy equipment. It's just a remarkable biochemical process that is being intensely studied because it's a very useful skill to have. And it's not one that we can, you know, we can spin fibers, but it's a not a particularly green process. So spiders use green chemistry to make these dry fibers.
Well, I just had to tell you that.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
And so thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Let's go over and talk with somebody next over in Belgium, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask you a question and make an observation that's kind of mixed here. I've noticed and I've heard that if you have cockroaches in your home, it's a sign that you don't have mice. And if you have mice, you do not have cockroaches, because mice like to eat cockroaches. Have you found that out before?
I think that might be kind of anecdotal and to some degree wishful thinking, at least in part, because mice have, there are multiple species of mice. I assume this refers to house mice, which are sort of pestiferous mice. It would seem highly likely that if there are food sources available in the home that don't run away, that mice would very likely prefer to feed on those. So I think it all depends on how rich in resources the particular dwelling is. I mean, they will certainly rodents eat cockroaches. I've noticed when occasionally we live in a wooded area and there are occasionally wood cockroaches again, and not the house infesting type, and they don't survive long when they attract the attention of our cats. But I've never actually seen any sort of statistically robust demonstration of an inverse correlation between mice and cockroaches.
Well, I've noticed at different times that whenever I've had cockroaches and stuff like that, and know that I've had mice, you'll see part of a cockroach left.
Yep. No question about it. They will eat cockroaches. But cockroaches have a phenomenal capacity for increase, and mice have a phenomenally broad diet. So it all kind of depends on what other resources are available.
Oh, I see. So it's kind of, if the mice get hungry enough, they'll eat the cockroaches, and the cockroaches will eat your scraps you lay around. So.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's a veritable ecosystem in some places. So, but you very well might have fewer cockroaches if you have mice, but I'm not sure I would encourage mice on that basis. So.
No. I was just thinking, well, if I see cockroaches, I must not have mice. If I have mice, I won't see cockroaches. I was wondering about that. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let me ask you a question here that has come in by email, and I hope that there'll be enough here detail to have you give an answer. This person says, at the end of April in West Urbana, particularly in Carl Park and along Oregon Street from Leal School to Kohler, they saw a lot of bees coming out of holes in the ground. Said more than they'd ever seen in past springs. They said the holes looked like large ant holes and spanned quarter block stretches, and there were lots of them, apparently lots of them. And following the last week's cold, rainy weather, the listener says the holes have disappeared, and wondering if you would have some idea what type of bees they were and maybe why it is they appeared in such large numbers. And do you think they'll be back?
My guess is, not having seen the bees, but it sounds like there's a group of bees. They're called, they used to be anthophorids. They're now anthophorine bees. I'm just trying to figure, remember what their common name, their common names are a little hard to keep track of. But they are ground nesting. They are related to other more familiar honeybees and bumblebees. In fact, anthophorines kind of look a little bit like honeybees. And I think that's white bee because I have a colleague who lives on Michigan, and he brought in a photograph of these bees. So, and they are ground nesting, and they form these aggregations in the ground, and they are not social. They don't have the complex social behavior of their relatives, the honeybees and bumblebees, Well, bumblebees are ground nesters, but they actually tend to nest in abandoned rodent burrows. And, of course, honeybees are cavity nesters in, like, trees and, you know, spaces in your attic and the like. So that would be my guess, is that they are – I don't want to say it wrong. They may be called digger bees. My bee colleagues, feel free to call and correct me. They're not particularly harmful. They do come out in the early spring. I'm still looking to make sure I get the common name right here. They're sort of grayish more than brown like the honeybees and yellow and black like the bumblebees. And I know that there are at least some nests in the State Street area in Urbana. Will they be back? A lot of these bees tend to be very seasonal tend to see them really only unlike the social bees that are abundant all year round. You tend to see them only periodically, and again, not knowing exactly which species the caller saw, my guess is that these were likely to be very seasonal. There are all kinds of bees. I mean, people don't realize there's 4,000 species of bees in North America, and most people are really only familiar with the very high-profile, larger bees. Mm-hmm. But there are all kinds of bees that are that live a solitary existence, and some of them nest in the ground. Halicted bees, some of them nest in the ground. Others nest in some of the small carpenter bee, for example, nests in stems of trees. But and they have name all kinds of names. Coletids are called plasterer bees, and I can never keep track of the common names. So, I'm pretty sure these are the anthophorines. They look like grayish honeybees, and they do nest in the ground and come out in early spring. I'll keep looking, and if my colleague Sydney Cameron is listening, she's a bee expert. We've got lots of experts in our on our faculty, so. I hope that helps.
All right. We're at our midpoint here. May Barenbaum is our guest. She's head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I. She's a scientist who specializes in studying insects, and every once in a while is here on the program. And we talk about insects, not we always say, save your extermination questions. This is an opportunity to appreciate them for them. There are many and varied and interesting forms. If there is something that you've seen, you can call in and give us the best description, and May will see if she can tell you what it is based on your description. Or if you have other sorts of insect questions, well, that's welcome to 333-9455. That's for here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Next caller is in Champaign and line one. Hello.
Hi. I have a situation connected with the bees as well. I have noticed in my vegetable garden the last few years an overabundance of bees that look to be black, and I guess they're bees, and that's the first question for you. And are these species also affected by the collapse of the similar to the honeybees?
Well, there are all kinds – bees have all kinds of problems. Colony collapse disorder is strictly used in reference to honeybees, and it's not even – all forms of death of honeybees. It's a sort of a syndrome characterized by sudden massive loss of the foragers. Honeybee workers go through this series of jobs as they age. When they come out as adults, first thing they do, first few days, they clean the hive, then they take care of the offspring and make cells, and then only the oldest, most experienced individuals become foragers. What happens in colony collapse disorder is the foragers all disappear. There's no collection of dead bodies. There's no They're just not in the colony. What's left is the queen and just a small contingent of very young workers, and that's not enough to maintain all the – to conduct all the jobs of the colony. Moreover, another characteristic of colony collapse disorder is that pests of bee colonies like the small hive beetle, wax moths, even other bees that like to come steal undefended colonies won't go near them. So colony collapse disorder is strictly used for honeybees. That said, as it turns out, there's a lot of bumblebees that are in trouble. Different dynamic, not exactly the same suite of symptoms. Basically, these guys are just disappearing. There's one sort of group of phylogenetically related bees. So this bumblebees, there are about 50 species, 49 species of bumblebees in the U.S. We in Illinois have about a dozen species. Well, actually, we used to have a dozen. But there's this one section of the genus, one group of related bees, four species in one little section of the genus, and they're all disappearing, and nobody exactly knows why. There's the prevailing hypothesis is that there's a new pathogen that affects only bumblebees that has come to this country just like those crazy raspberry ants inadvertently. In this case, bumblebees are used for pollinating in greenhouses. They're very good at pollinating tomatoes in greenhouses. And in Holland, they've developed individuals have developed methods for maintaining these bumblebee colonies for pollination purposes, so managing these colonies. So some time ago, American bees were shipped to Holland basically for domestication and then shipped back. And the thought is these colonies that were shipped back and then sent all over the country for greenhouse pollination may have brought back this pathogen in the genus Nosema. And that's what's killing these very susceptible bees. The Bombus affinis is the species called the rusty-patched bumblebee that used to be quite common in Illinois, and nobody's seen it in years. So so that's a different situation, but it's as dire for the bumblebees. And frankly, all these other bees that I mentioned, the low-profile, smaller bees, we really don't know very much about them. So they may be in trouble, but we just don't have a baseline.
Is there any indication that pollination is being taken up by other insects?
Interesting question. When honeybees were hit by the varroa mite, this is yet another introduced invasive species that was accidentally brought over in the 1980s, around 87, and absolutely has devastated honeybees, but particularly wild or unmanaged colonies, feral colonies. That what happens, this is a mite that, relative to the size of the developing bee, is about as if you were being attacked by lobsters. It's a relatively large parasite if you're a bee. Gets into the cells when the larvae are metamorphosing into pupae. And pupa is helpless, right, and it can't defend itself. It can't clean itself, can't do anything. And that's when the varroa mites go to town, sucking the hemolymph for blood out. And it can just cause a colony to just basically disappear, or just die. And as a consequence, feral honeybees used to be very common in this country. Wild honeybees, nobody was managing. They just, lived in a tree somewhere. And now they're very hard to find. You just don't encounter them quite as frequently. And it's thought that that's as a consequence of varroa. Very long and involved answer to the question. It has been observed, but not very well documented, that bumblebees, other species of bumblebees, not the ones in trouble, may actually have enjoyed a resurgence due to a release from competition of honeybees, which are very, very good flower visitors. They've got huge colonies, 30, 40,000 workers. They can handle almost any kind of flower. They get up early in the morning, work late at night. They're hard to compete with. So it's been suggested that maybe there's been a resurgence of some of the native bees as a consequence of the loss of feral honeybees. But again, not very many people were paying much attention. We don't really have very robust data. That's just sort of anecdotal. But what happens if we lose honeybees and bumblebees? That's a good question, because some of the solitary bees are not like bumblebees and honeybees. They're very specific in their flower choices. There's a native Melipona bee. It's called the squash bee. As the name suggests, it only visits flowers in the squash family. So it kind of depends on who's around and how versatile they are as to whether or not they're filling in for the missing honeybees and bumblebees.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, is that when you you look at those particular bees that actually have been studied, is it the case that they've been studied because they have an important significance in agriculture, because they pollinate commercial crops?
Well, actually, the only reason we know as much about bumblebees as we do is that there's a handful of very dedicated bumblebee workers who have not. I mean, bumblebee
scientists.
Right. Not bumblebee.
Not bumblebee workers.
You see them at the lab. How do you work a microscope with compound eye? That would be really hard. No. Who have just on their own been monitoring things for decades. And as it turns out, as honeybees have been experiencing these problems, there are other individuals who have begun the scientific investigation of estimating the contributions of wild bees to commercial agriculture. And there was a recent report that estimating that contribution is worth about $3 billion a year. So honeybees really, in their current state, cannot handle all of the needs of commercial pollination, and that unrecorded, unheralded, and unbeknownst to most people, wild pollinators were contributing and are contributing significantly to crop pollination. And now, nobody is estimating the contributions of these wild pollinators to natural habitats, and that's probably inestimable. Certain crops in particular, honeybees aren't that especially adept at, and the contributions of wild pollinators are extremely important. All the native crops, honeybees aren't native, so they're not really great at such crops as blueberries and cranberries. Those are native North American crops. Even tomatoes, they can't really pollinate tomatoes very well. Some of the native squashes and melons, things that are native to North America, tend to be more efficiently pollinated by our native bees. Honeybees can do it by just sheer brute force, you know, because there's so many of them and they're so busy and industrious. So, but I'm not quite sure. I think we probably covered it, and the question drove it into the ground a few feet. So.
All right.
I just did find anthophorids are called digger bees, but here's the trouble I have with these common names. The andrenids, they call the acute-tongued burrowing bees. Not exactly a catchy common name. So.
Okay. Let's keep going here. We'll talk with next someone in Urbana, and this would be line number 2. Hello.
Hi, good morning. Mm-hmm. I have a question about the behavior of a fly. In the summertime, when I'm outdoors cutting wood, that is plywood and lumber, with my circular saw, there's a fly that comes to the saw right when it's cutting, just for the few seconds that the saw is on and cutting the wood. It's a very large gray-colored fly with longitudinal stripes, and it only comes to the cut when I'm cutting. It doesn't seem to be attracted to me or, you know, my perspiration or anything like that. It only happens when I'm cutting. Have you ever heard of that?
Actually, that can be a problem. Many flies at time of courtship orient to sound, particular frequencies are attractive signals for purposes of mating. Don't get alarmed. We're not talking about cross classes here. But mosquitoes, for example, if you look at a male and a female mosquito, male mosquitoes have bushy antennae, and these bushy antennae are just studded with sound receptors. And that really irritating drone that can drive you nuts in the summer, that's actually one of the signals that's used to attract females will attract males with that sound. Other flies use sound to form mating assemblages. And in some cases, with mosquitoes, certain kinds of industrial machinery get so clogged with bodies of, you know, would-be suitors that they stop working. So my guess is your fly admirer is attracted by whatever the frequency is of your power saw. In terms of identifying a large gray fly with longitudinal stripes, there's a lot of flies that are gray and longitudinally striped. There are some tachinids that are parasitic on other insects. There's a whole group of mussid flies like the house fly and some of its relatives. cluster flies. There's a whole bunch of them with that general gestalt. But a lot of them do buzz, and a lot of them use that buzz for finding each other.
Well, I suppose that's flattering. Thanks very much.
All right. Next caller is in Mahomet, line 3. Hello.
Hi, May. Great show.
Hi. Thank you.
Say the ground nesting bee, that's most likely Colides.
Oh, okay.
It's
the plasterer bee, right?
Plasterer bees, or another common name, because they line their burrows, underground burrows, with
described as polyester in some cases.
Yeah, it looks like cellophane.
Yeah.
And they only come out in the early spring, and I get a lot of calls with people all upset about these thousands and thousands
yeah.
of bees. And it's primarily males that are swarming around trying to mate with females. And the important thing is that they don't sting. The females do not sting. And so homeowners and so forth get very upset and want to know if they should put down a lot of pesticides and stuff. But I tell them basically they're doing you a job by aerating your soil. And leave them alone. They'll be gone in a couple of weeks.
Right, yeah.
They do tend to come back to the same site every year.
That's good. And these are in the State Streets?
Pardon me?
These are in the State Street area of Urbana?
They would be in Urbana. Yeah. You know John Marlin. He has one
mm-hmm.
right in front
okay.
of his house.
Okay, yeah.
And so they caused a lot of excitement, but they're harmless.
Yeah, I got a call about, somebody was worried. They found a mass of honeybees rolling around in the ground. And I thought,
yeah.
Wait a minute. And then when I saw a picture and they were clearly mating, it was obviously not honeybees because honeybees mate 50 feet in the air
sure.
and it's only one individual who's mating. So it's likely these were the Colletids that are rolling around the ground in this sort of orgiastic spring ritual.
Keep the
here.
Children away, that's
yeah.
what I say.
Don't worry about stinging, but you can worry about sort of childhood trauma or something. So that's the birds and the bees. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Can I ask who's calling? Or?
Ron McGinley.
Oh, okay, the bee expert. Great.
Oh,
thank
good,
you so much.
Okay.
Thanks for helping us out.
Now, he knows, so this is for sure these are Colletids. So.
All right. Are there many other bees that don't sting?
Well, the thing about stinging is a stinger in a bee is a modified egg-laying device. So usually the bees you have to watch out for, wasps, are the ones that make these large nests because these are the truly social individuals and the social species. And the egg-laying has been basically delegated to a few or one reproductive individual. In the case of honeybees, it's one. And the other individuals are sterile workers who use their stingers to defend the colony. If the species isn't social, there's no colony to defend, and there isn't much of a reason to worry to exert the effort to make powerful venom and develop these defensive behaviors. Now, some of the wasps are carnivorous and use their stingers to kill prey and can give you a nasty sting, but it's generally the wasps you have to watch out for are also the ones with big nests in defense. You know, the stinging is not out of malice or ill temper. It's because they're defending a nest or a home. And even honeybees, if they're not near their home, are not that anxious to sting you. They do die when they sting you. Not every yellow jackets don't die, but honeybees do. So if you see a swarm hanging on a tree, I've gotten a couple of emails too saying they seem really very peaceable. Well, they are. They're very disoriented. They don't have a home yet. They're in transit to a new home. And if they're not defending a home, they're not particularly anxious to sting. So, you know, it's true. About 40 people die every year from hymenopteran stings. And it's usually because of hypersensitivity and anaphylaxis. Mm. But think of the numbers. I mean, lightning strikes. There's more danger from lightning strikes. People have kind of magnified the risks and consequences of being stung. And that's sort of not an accident. Stings of social insects are really designed not to kill you, but to hurt you and make you remember. There are far more pain-inducing components in hymenopteran venom, social hymenopteran venom, than there are really lethal components. Moreover, in honeybee venom, there's a component called apomin, which facilitates the transfer of short-term memory into long-term memory and is thought to aid in instructing vertebrates to avoid stinging hymenopterans. Mm. And it, again, if you ask almost anybody, do you remember the first time you were stung? It's amazing how many people do remember. And it's likely that, you know, that's the whole purpose of venom, is to teach enemies to leave bees alone, and not just to kill them, but not expressly to kill them, but just instead to teach them a lesson.
All right, very good. Let's continue. We'll go next to Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hi. I have a question about the compound eye of an insect. You know, usually when you see pictures of what the insect might see, they have a give you a picture of each facet bringing up an entire image. There must be some place along the line in that tiny brain of theirs that integrates all of those images into one.
Well, this is the so-called science fiction eye view, where, like a Fresnel lens, you get 24 images of Joan Collins screaming as the queen ant is spraying her with pheromone. That memorable scene from Empire of the Ants.
And as we all, I think, would agree, just one image of Joan Collins would be
quite enough.
Plenty, yeah.
As it turns out, that's not really what entomologists believe is how images are formed by compound eyes. A better analogy is a newspaper photo, which is made up of a range of light and dark spots. So the general thought now is that the compound eye is a mosaic image-forming eye. So it's not that it has multiple full-scene images, but rather there are components of images that are assembled.
So it's kind of like the human eye without the lens in front.
Interesting concept.
Because, there are rods and cones in the human eye also pick up, or I should say the receptive fields, because that's really what you're talking about, picks up individual parts of the picture.
Yeah, well, and that said, each of those individual facets or omatidia does have a lens, but it's just a different process.
Right.
And as it turns out, this kind of image formation is extremely useful for detecting motion, and that seems to be really important. It's more important for insects than forming, clear images of particular objects. Because, think about it. If you're a tiny, or if you're a dragonfly flying at 20 miles per hour, it would get a real headache trying to form successive, images. Rather, it's more important to process that, movement rather than individual tableaus.
It's interesting when you get down to the primitive beast like that, even down to the frog. The frog is very sensitive to motion. So it can pick up a piece of hamburger meat that's sitting on the hour hand of a clock. And you can find that in science in 1960.
I wonder what possessed anyone to set up that experiment, though.
Well, I know the story behind it, because the fellow's name was Walter Case, and his 10-year-old son came up with the idea. And so his son had a publication in Science Magazine at the age of...
All right.
Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you. I just have to say, apropos of the movie, science fiction movie version of how insects see, it raised a question in my mind as to whether insects could actually watch a motion picture. As one of these science fiction films, what do they see? This relates to one reason we see movies as movies is called flicker fusion frequency. Our eyes can't, if you project images at 24 frames per second, basically our brain can't differentiate those images. And what we get is a perception of continuous motion. And there are many insects that have much higher flicker fusion frequencies than we do. So they may actually watch movies about themselves and just see them as like more like a flip book or turning the pages of a family photo album really quickly. It's not an issue that has bothered anybody, any other entomologist. It's not a subject for intense research, but I always wondered if insects could watch movies.
Have you ever invited any insects to the Insect Fear Film Festival?
I can't say that we have. Well, they stay in the lobby mostly. So.
We have one more caller. We'll get White Heath, line number two. Hello.
Hi. I'm calling about an insect you were talking about earlier that lives in the ground. And now I have a whole bunch of those in my yard. I've called in the past years, and it just keeps... They're called cicada killers. I don't know if you were talking about that or not.
No, actually, cicada killers tend to show up later in the season.
Yes, they do.
Yeah. Did you want to
have a special... Well, they make, how they live.
Uh-huh.
But now they just keep getting more and more. I just keep getting more and more of them every year. And they just make little spots in my yard so mm-hmm. that they kill the grass. So I have all those little holes all over my yard, and they just keep getting worse and worse. I don't know how to deal with them.
Well, here's the—you should probably—I think Monday Phil Nixon will be on.
Oh, okay.
When you say that to me, I think how lucky that you are to have those.
Really?
Well, they're just such remarkable—the biggest wasp in Eastern North America. I think they're amazing. They're highly unlikely to sting you.
We've never been stung, they make all these holes in my front yard. I wish they'd go in the backyard.
Is your front yard sort of sandy at all? Or?
Well, right out here it's very clayey, but I don't know. I suppose maybe there's some sand.
That tends to be the kind of soil they like.
Yeah.
So maybe the best defense is if you really want to get rid of them, but you should talk to Phil. But I know they like particular soil type. They're really very common on campus and sort of where sandy soil. There's sandy soil.
Why are they good then? Tell me.
I like most insects. They are
just like the insects.
They have this
so
incredible ability. Imagine, even though they're big wasps, what they do is find cicadas, sting them, paralyze them, and then use them, to feed their grubs underground.
Yeah, exactly.
But it would be the equivalent of you or me flying, carrying a cow.
No, I know.
Because
I've seen
the cicadas are huge and heavy.
Yeah,
it is unbelievable.
Yeah.
You got to admire that kind of,
mind a couple, but...
That's true.
We must have like 100 little spots now on mine.
Yeah.
And I don't have that big of a yard, really.
Well, call back on, I think it's Monday, and Phil can give you some practical solutions. Instead of, for me, I'd say, well, hey, charge admission to the neighborhood for these cicada killer circus,
Well... I suppose that would be some grass and just go with the cicada killers. All right, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, yes, I definitely could see if you had one or two, that would be one thing. But if you have 100, that might get to be a bit of a nuisance.
A bit tiresome,
particularly if they were kind of tearing up your lawn.
And if you like cicadas, it's really bad news.
Yeah, well, I don't know that I have really strong feelings for cicadas, but, you like to have everything have its place and be in balance and, not to disturb the natural order of things too much. You figure, well, okay, the cicada killers, I guess they got as much a right to do their thing as I do. For people, as I always say when Meg is here, the first thing I say is save the extermination stuff. We got a guy for that. Well, so then it sounds like, the host is always the last to know. I don't know what I'm doing. But sometime soon here, Phil will be here. Phil Nixon, he's an extension entomologist, and his special area is trying to help people deal with insect pests. So if it's to the point where it's that serious of a deal, he can help you out. But a lot of times, we talk about him being the kill the bugs guy. But in fairness, I want to make sure people understand. Phil loves bugs.
He likes them
as much as May does. And even though his job is to help people get rid of them, many times I have heard him say in response to somebody who said I have this problem, trying to suggest to people, can you live with this? Is this something that's really a problem? If it is, okay, I'll tell you what to do.
I don't think
he's
probably never promoted the idea of a cicada killer circus, though.
No.
That's a non-starter.
But, there have been flea circuses.
Yep.
I never really quite understood.
I can go on about that. Anything impractical, I can tell you about.
I always wondered, is that a joke?
Nope.
But about how do you train a flea? And the costumes. I mean, how can you get them that small?
Well,
Little tiny red noses.
In fact, there's a form of folk art in Mexico that are called dressed fleas. And people make little tableaus with the little fleas and little articles of clothing. Training fleas for a flea circus, there's a range of things. Sometimes if you just strap swords and little wagons on them, all you see is their frantic effort to escape. But you can actually coordinate Busby Berkeley-like displays by keeping adult fleas in containers of different sizes. And they basically hop and habituate to particular heights. So when you actually release them, then you can get sort of a coordinated form of display. There's an extensive flea circus literature, and there's a really splendid exhibit on flea circuses in the Circus Museum in Baraboo, Wisconsin, if anybody's up in that area.
Well, that's interesting. I've been there. I don't recall
you
that particular. I missed the flea circus. See, anybody else told me this, I would say, you're pulling my leg. But, but since it's you, of course, I have to believe you.
Pulling all six legs. Right?
Exactly so. Well, I guess we'll finish up for this time around. Sometime soon, later this summer, I'm sure May will be back and we'll do this again. In the meantime, she's authored a bunch of books like, let's say, Buzzwords, A Scientist Muses on Sex, Bugs, and Rock and Roll, which is a collection of columns that she wrote. There's 99 Gnats, Knits, and Nibblers. It's published by the U of I Press. And there's 99 more Maggots, Mites, and Munchers and other books. So look for them. Ask for them by name where you buy books.
And there's a new one will be coming out, I think, this December. So.
Oh, in that, another one of the third
no,
one
this
of that?
Is a,
oh,
a
complete, something different completely
one.
Different. Okay. And May is the head of the Department of Entomology here at the U of I. Thank you.
Thank you.